From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Legendary rocker Greg Allman made music right up until his death this year.
I thank God for the longevity of my career.
That's Greg Allman on this show in 2015. Ahead this hour, we'll hear from his final album, Southern Blood, which came out earlier this month. But first, a history of activism in sports and why conversations about race are some of the hardest to have. We want to hear from you as always. What do you think about pro athletes sitting out the national anthem as a form of protest? Call us 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. Last week, President Trump disparaged professional football players for kneeling during the national anthem.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
The president's comments seemed to spark far more players to engage in such protests at NFL games this past Sunday. The Atlanta Falcons were among the many players, coaches, and owners who locked arms during the anthem to protest racial injustice. 50 years ago, two Olympic athletes brought this kind of silent protest to the medal podium. Track stars Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists in a Black Power salute during the ceremony. My colleague Celeste Headlee spoke with Tommy Smith last year after he and John Carlos were honored by President Barack Obama.
I wanted to actually play a comment to get our conversation started from John Carlos, and I asked him about higher paid athletes like Serena Williams becoming more politically active, and then some cautioning that, say, for example, Serena could hurt her career and hurt her earnings if she starts speaking out on political issues. And here's what John Carlos said about that.
It's not about the money. That's what Mr. Kaepernick is saying right now. You know, when I made my statement 28, 48 years ago, I had $13 in my bank account. This young man had $13 million in his account. He's showing the rest of the athletes, this is not about how much money you have or how much money you don't have. You know, Serena, I'm sure she will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. I'm sure Mr. Kaepernick will survive if they took the endorsements away from her. If they feel that, you know, that they're going to move her away from endorsements because she chose to stand up for what's right in society, I don't need those products anyway, if that's the attitude those individuals have, because it makes me think maybe behind closed doors, those sponsors might have a different view about how society should be run.
So let me ask you about that, Tommy Smith. Did it run through your mind at all how your message in back in 1968 might affect your career, your earnings, your future?
Well, you know, it depends on the individual. John Carlos was talking about it. It depends on the individual how one might view any type of involvement such as this. It also has a lot to do with gender and the involvement on and the succession in society. You know, we had no money back then, and we decided to do this because it was a needed thing to do, and we did it from a college perspective and not a financial perspective. I had no career. I had no education. My sacrifice was a little bit different than both people who have money. One can view it as I have my money, therefore I can do anything I want to. Another aspect could be I have my money, and I want to give a decision to the listeners or to the hearers or to the seers or to the doers that it doesn't matter how much money I have. It's from the soul and not from the financial standpoint or financial banking system. So it depends on the individual. You can't take a Serena and put her in the same category as Tommy Smith. You can't take Kaepernick and put him in the same category as John Carlos. These are individual moves that the participant have. So don't put me in the same package as you put someone else who does the same thing. We have different ideas about what we're doing. As long as it's nonviolent, as long as it pertains to the system, as long as it pertains to inequality or policing and nonviolent change, I think the conversation should be around what one think about it themselves and not categorize it with a group of people who are doing something very similar.
Now, the Kaepernick we're referring to is San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick. He continues his protest. He continues to kneel during the national anthem before games. And he told reporters his purpose is to bring greater attention to the issue of police violence and social injustice.
There's people being murdered unjustly and not being held accountable. Cops are getting paid leave for killing people. That's not right. I'll continue to sit. I'm going to continue to stand with the people that are being oppressed. To me, this is something that has to change. And when there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
So without putting the both of you in the same category, Tommy, there is a similarity to the symbolism of your action and then that of Colin Kaepernick. Yours was on a world stage.
Yeah,
so when something is a symbolic gesture, what is the effectiveness of this? How effective can a gesture like that be?
Well, if you get the ball across the plate, you can throw a 98-mile-an-hour ball, you can throw a 65-mile-an-hour ball, as long as it's going toward the same point of a concern. That I can understand. But in 68, we had a platform of South Africa, Rhodesia, more coaches, more African-American or coaches of color hired, housing. We had things that were identifying to the college campus and the human rights issue. So we had two different things going at the same time, and people understood that by us being black athletes, Americans, and the human rights issue. Yes, we were both throwing the ball toward the plate, but they both had different speeds because of where we were in society, what platform we took, etc. Serena would be in a different category, and depending on what she stood or what she wouldn't do because of how she believed. It's a sociological point that one must keep as straight as possible and identify what they're trying to do, not doing it because someone else is doing it. And I don't believe the athletes who are doing with Colin is doing it because they're trying to back him. They're doing it because what he's doing they also agree with.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Olympic athlete Tommy Smith, who won the gold medal in the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City. So we got this tweet from a listener. Question, where does activism belong? Bart tweets, answer, nowhere. So it has to belong exactly where it doesn't belong. That's what makes it activism. And this is something that I brought up with John Carlos as well. In response to the people who say Colin Kaepernick is an athlete and he needs to focus on his sport and quit making political statements. Here's what John Carlos said.
That's a stupid statement. That's the same stupid-ass statement that they made 48 years ago. How do you tell an individual that you are suspended from society because you're an athlete, that you shouldn't have any concerns about the well-being of those individuals that you grew up with in your community? That's like telling a minister he's not supposed to go to church on Sunday.
So how do you feel about this particular issue? Those who are saying Colin Kaepernick's being paid for a job and kneeling during the national anthem or making a political protest is not part of that job.
Let's continue where John left off. I think it's a comment the individual called in is just as bad as the decision the 1968 that the president of the IOC made about John Carlos and Tommy Smith, saying that movements like Carlos and Smith has no place in the Olympic movement. But in 1936, he was in injustice or in favor of being ruled or moved like the SS of Hitler. I think people in any position, even Colin Kaepernick, has a right to voice his opinion in this particular flow of life. Now, it's hard because some people, just like I did a few minutes ago, stumble over a need to identify specifically. There's no specifics about what Colin Kaepernick has or have not delved in before he did this. Yes, he has a concern. He used the only platform that he knew how, or the only platform that he had was to voice his opinion. And I think anyone who says that play your sports and let everything else go, they take the humanistic point out of that person's life.
Do you feel as though your protest ended up impacting your future and your career? Do you think it changed the course of your life?
Well, I had not lived that life before. So I can only say that what I viewed, I believe it had a tendency to make people view me negatively because it had never been done before. And the ideal cause of why it was done was the same reason those people decided to call in and refute the physical movement that John Carlos and Tommy Smith had, because they knew either. Status quo is always safe to live in, because the only place you're going to hurt is what you're sitting on. We move in an optimistic position, nonviolently, to make a change in what we were standing for. We had a reason to stand because we pointed the reason out. Then we said nothing about the reason because we had already spoken what we were trying to do an entire year before. How do you think that the athletes on that team knew the need for us to do what we did? Each athlete, and it was decided by this before we got to Mexico, that each athlete would represent himself according to how he felt the country represented them. So it was nonviolent, and each athlete had a part in playing with how he believed.
So let me play you one more comment that your former colleague John Carlos said. And this is when I was asking about whether or not athletes, because of their position, are obliged to stand up for what they think is injustice. And here was his response.
How you trying to do when they have obligation, when they can wait until their mama get hit across the head or get killed because they came to the wrong house? You darn too, they have obligation, you know. And for individuals such as Shaq and Jerry Rice changed his mind. But I see all of the naysayers out there. And the question is, down the line, how are they going to come out in history? Which side of the road are they going to be classified on that day?
What do you think about that, whether or not athletes are obliged to use the position they've been given to speak out?
It's their position. They fought for that position. They can do what they feel is necessary while they're in that position. And I do think it's a necessity for athletes, especially athletes, who have a world stage to proactively move in a direction to make a nation stronger. There are those who say what we did is freedom enough. I don't believe freedom comes in what other people say about what I just did. Constitutionally speaking, that's where the freedom is, and it is written. And if one doesn't get it, it is written in the Constitution to say one must lobby to change it. So the athletes are in a position to change the eyes of young folks who are coming up. They need a platform, and this is a nonviolent platform. They can talk all they want, but they must have a plan to explain what they mean about what they do. And of course, anytime you go against status quo, there's going to be different nonviolent attitudes toward what one does, and no malicious intent. Nonviolence is the answer, and whether it's directly or indirectly. Consequences, yes, they must be understood, must have a plan to explain, and follow up with verbal explanation. Nonviolence is the finality of explanation. Period. Sad.
Former Olympic gold medal winner Tommy Smith now lives in Georgia. He and fellow Olympic track athlete John Carlos sparked an international debate after raising their fists during the 1968 medal ceremony. They spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley last year. Just ahead, why is it so hard for people to talk about race? Then one more album from the late, great Greg Allman. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. My next guest has spent years working to understand the psychology of racism. In 1997, former Spelman College president Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum wrote a book called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. 20 years later, she's updated the book, and she speaks tonight at the Atlanta History Center. Beverly Daniel Tatum, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Adam.
I first flipped through your book sometime in the mid-2000s when my wife had been assigned to read it as part of her graduate studies in higher ed administration. And I tell that story right now just to underline for the listeners how important, how significant that text has become. It's really sort of the foundational text for understanding contemporary race relations and racial identity, at least for people in education field in particular. I wonder if for people who have not read the book, could you sum up its basic observation, the original book from 1997?
Sure. Well, when I wrote the book in 1997, my goal was to help readers understand what racism is, how it operates in our society, and how it impacts all of us in terms of how we think about ourselves, in terms of our racial identity, and ultimately how understanding racial identity across lines of difference can improve our capacity to connect with one another and ultimately work together to end racism in our society.
And what's different in the book that you've just put out now, the updated edition, 20 years later?
Well, 20 years later, our social context has changed, and I wanted to really reflect on those changes, the demographic changes, the change in our way of talking about race, the focus that many people had, for example, following the election of President Obama on what was referred to as a post-racial society, recognizing that we are not in a post-racial era and that some of the same problems that haunted us in 1997 are still with us in 2017. Yet we have a new generation of young people that has come of age in a context that makes it very difficult for them to even know where to begin in these conversations.
You write also about the significant demographic change that has continued over the last 20 years.
Absolutely. We know that, I often use this statistic. I was born in 1954, and in the 50s, 90% of the U.S. population was white. In 2014, more than half of the school-age population was made up of children of color. That's a dramatic change, and certainly we see continued growth, certainly in the Latinx population, and the fastest growing population in the U.S. is actually the Asian American population, though only 6% currently the fastest growing, largely as a result of immigration.
I wonder if that dramatic demographic change is one of the reasons why we seem as a society to be paying a little bit more attention lately to the concept of white identity and white identity politics, which surely have always been very significant in American life, but they seem to be getting called out more explicitly lately. And I wonder if maybe it's sort of a natural effect of whites gradually slipping out of their position as the clear majority in the United States, that they're going to maybe naturally identify more as a group and want to advocate for themselves as a group.
Well, I do think that the rhetoric around the loss of majority status, the impending loss, it hasn't happened yet, but the shift in the population has raised racial anxieties for some people. I certainly think that the rhetoric among people like Richard Spencer and other white nationalists has certainly been pushing people to think in that direction. I do think it's important to acknowledge that everybody has a racial identity in a race-conscious society. But it is certainly the case that if you grow up, as many white people do, in largely white communities, attending mostly white schools, working in mostly white working settings, you may not be thinking much about the meaning of whiteness, the meaning of your identity relative to the advantages that are built into our society, the benefit of the doubt that white people receive in so many different contexts. The idea of white privilege is the term white privilege has become for many people an uncomfortable one because they feel like, what privilege have I got? But at the same time, if you understand the way racism works, you cannot deny that there are still systematic benefits accrued to people because of their white skin that people of color do not automatically receive.
We're talking to psychologist and former Spelman College president, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, author of the landmark 1997 book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? She's just updated it for the 21st century, and she'll be speaking tonight at the Atlanta History Center. So many conversations about race, at least conversations about race involving white people, tend to kind of reach an impasse around this idea. White people would say, listen, I don't hate you, person of color, because of the color of your skin. I have a problem with you because of things that have, at least in my opinion, nothing to do with the color of your skin. Certainly, President Trump has articulated that point of view. He will say that I don't have a problem with these black athletes protesting the national anthem because they're black. I have a problem with them protesting the national anthem. Therefore, racism is not related to this particular dispute that we're having. I imagine Dr. Tatum, that you would say that that's a simplistic view of racism?
Of course, the first thing I want to say is that the athletes are not protesting the anthem. The athletes are protesting racial injustice, particularly around the criminal justice system. That is what prompted Colin Kaepernick's original protest, and I think it's important that we continue to clarify that. That said, I do think that many people think about racism as simply individual attitudes, prejudices, and they don't acknowledge, and certainly in the statements that President Trump has been making, he has not acknowledged the systematic policies and practices that have long been baked into our system, whether we talk about our criminal justice system or we're talking about housing or access to employment or education. One of the things I talk about in my book is that even though we've seen this demographic shift, we also still have persistent residential and school segregation. In fact, today's public schools are more segregated than they were 20 years ago. So the systemic nature of racism really needs to be confronted and talked about. And that's one of the challenges, I think. I think I always appreciate when people say the whole title of my book, and you did, because the
first time, sorry.
No, but the title, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race, it's the conversations about race that I think is really the most critical component, because people are uncomfortable talking about it, and you can't solve a problem if you can't talk about it.
I work at the Center for Collaborative Journalism at Mercer University down in Macon, and for the last year, we've been working on a reporting project about the resegregation of Macon's public schools, which is really quite dramatic if we look at the numbers, as we have done. At a public forum that we had on the subject not too long ago, a white fellow got up and talked about how his decision to put his child into a private school, and he said, listen, we don't have any problem with black people. I want my son to grow up with people who aren't like him. But, you know, what we have a problem with is the lack of discipline and all of the social problems that are present in these public schools. We just wanted our son to go to a school where he wouldn't have to deal with all of that. And so it has nothing to do with him not wanting our son to attend school with black people. It's just about wanting him to attend a good school, a high functional school. And sort of what I wanted to say to him in that moment, and as a journalist and as a sort of a convener of that conversation, it really wasn't my place. And also, I don't know, as a white person, something about saying what I'm about to say makes me a little bit uncomfortable, but it's a safe space. What I wanted to say to him was, listen, you know, black people suffer tremendous social and economic disadvantages in this country. And with those disadvantages come all kinds of social problems that manifest at school. And if you don't want your son to go to school in the presence of those challenges, then that is saying that you don't want your son to attend school with black people. That is the black condition in America. Was that a good response?
Well, I think it certainly is a good response in the sense of challenging the rhetoric. And I think that it is absolutely the case that sometimes people conflate blackness with poverty, and certainly those two things go together. And anytime people are struggling with poverty, there are social issues that accompany that poverty, whether that's kids coming to school without having food to eat or having a reliable place to live at night, or, you know, any number of other social concerns that are associated with poverty. That said, I do think it's important to point out that according to a recent survey, which I discuss in the book, by the Public Religion Research Institute, 75% of white people have entirely white social networks without any minority presence. And this degree of social network homogeneity, I mean, the fact that you don't have any people of color in your social network means you have no conversations with people of color. And that means that the conversation that's happening among many white people is with other white people. And that is kind of an echo chamber in the sense of not really understanding what other people's perspectives are or what their experiences are. And I think young children growing up without multiple perspectives are at risk of not being able to function very effectively in what is an increasingly diverse society.
In our last minute, what's one thing that everyone can do to have more productive conversations about race?
Risk some discomfort. You know, if we expect to be comfortable all the time, we won't be able to have those conversations. But if we understand that if I have this conversation and keep having it, I will build trust with the people I'm talking to. And over time, I'm going to understand their perspective better. They're going to understand mine. And collectively, we can take action. Talk should lead to productive action. It's not talking for talk's sake. It's for making positive change.
That's former Spelman College president Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race. The book that originally came out in 1997 is out in a new updated edition this year, and she's going to speak tonight at the Atlanta History Center at 8 o'clock. Dr. Tatum, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
On Thursday's show, we'll do more than scratch the surface on cat ownership. The big question, should pet cats be allowed to go outside? We want to hear from you. Do you let your cat roam or not? Maybe you have strong feelings about someone else's cat? Tweet to us at OST Talk or give us a call, 404-500-9457. Atlanta now has its first coffee shop devoted to cat lovers. The Java Cats Cafe opened earlier this year. It offers two sections, one to drink coffee with humans, the other to hang out with adoptable cats. GPB's Sean Powers sends us this audio postcard from the Java Cats Cafe.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks. If you have any questions, let me know. Most of the cats here have collars on that have their names on them. Blue is male, pink is female. Do you guys have cats at home?
Two.
Awesome. Okay, well, you're good to go. Just have fun. My name is Rachel Whitmire, and I'm a cat lounge host here, and my job is to make sure the cats are interacting well with all of our guests and that they have enough food and water and a clean place to use a litter box, and then also to figure out what their favorite toys are. That is a meowing piano.
Meow, 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 meow,
meow, meow, meow, meow, meow, meow.
He seems to like it.
Hello.
They're all so sweet. I just love cats.
I'm Tita Lovell. I'm a teacher. I'm wearing a black cat t-shirt. I'm a big cat nerd, so it's right up my alley. No pun intended. I think cats just have a personality, and what I like about them is that you have to get to know the cat to really understand the cat, you know. As opposed to a dog, like, you know a dog from the get-go. This dog is happy, and that's the dog. As opposed to, like, it's a person. You know, if you meet somebody new, you have to take time to get to know them, and cats are the same way.
This is Olivia. She's been adopted. That's Mama Turnip. She is very unhappy.
Would you like a treat?
If only had a video right now. The cat's trying to crawl out the window.
My name is Britt Mayo. I do field operations, basically data collection for a technology company. Right now I'm seeing lots and lots of toys. This is, so people can visualize it, almost like a skate park except for cats. There are ramps and there are little jumper boards for the cats to go up the walls, kind of diagonally, one board to the next. It's kind of a cat's dream playscape.
Okay, I give you one.
I used to have a black cat. He liked my roommate more, so I gave him to my roommate. My name's Bridget Bott. It's really cool. It's a different experience. So I love cats and I love coffee. So it's cool for the two to be together.
And then once it's at a blood temperature, you dunk it to where it's nice and silent, and you're just heating the milk to that perfect temperature. My name is Chris Mason. I am the certified barista trainer here at Java Cats. My wife was the one that told me about this place. I was going to school and working at a burrito shop, and my wife came up to me and said, like, Chris, there's a place that's serving coffee and cats, and you're really good at coffee, and I want to pet cats, so you need to go apply there and get a job.
My name is Hayden Hilton, and I am the owner of Java Cats Cafe.
I just hope, you know, in a year from now we're still successful, still doing high number of adoptions, that we, you know, live beyond the hype. Right now people are really excited about this new, different idea, but I want it to be a staple coffee shop in Atlanta, and just people come for the coffee, not necessarily always for the cats, or people come for the cats, not necessarily for the coffee, but just be a great coffee shop that, you know, is giving back to the community.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. You can hang out at the Cat Cafe, too, but you will need a reservation. For details on how to make one and for photos from the cafe, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, we hear from the final album by Greg Allman. This is On Second Thought. On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusea. Hearts broke in Georgia and across the world when Greg Allman died in May of this year at his home in Savannah. But Allman left a part of his legacy behind yet to be discovered. In the years leading up to his death, Allman and his band worked on an album at Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where the shoots of the Allman Brothers Band first sprouted in the 1960s. It's called Southern Blood, and this record is mostly of new material, and it came out earlier this month following Allman's death. Legendary music producer Don Was worked closely with Allman on the album, and we caught up with Don Was yesterday.
Hello, my name is Don Was. I'm a record producer, musician. There are a myriad of emotions I experienced making this record. There's clearly an air of gravitas around what we're doing, knowing that he probably wasn't going to be around to do interviews like this. We also had a really good time. He always wanted to make a record with his touring band that he put together. He was really proud of that band. There's a sound he always heard in his head that he felt he never got on records before. That made that my mission, to help him achieve that sound. And we were getting it, and he was really happy about it.
Suddenly out of left field, out of left field.
But I could tell as we started choosing songs, he was gravitating towards songs that had some relevance to what was going on in his life. It seemed as though there was a kind of a theme emerging of Greg tying up the loose ends in his life. I think he did that. It was therapeutic for himself, as well as something that I think he really wanted to do for the fans who stuck with him for decades. Probably the most direct song on the album is what I view as really a kind of a confessional piece that Greg wrote along with his guitar player, Scott Sherrard. Opens the record. It's called My Only True Friend. And it begins with the lines, "You and I both know this river will surely come to an end.
You and I both know this river will surely flow to an end." Soul on a man.
The thing that really struck me was that he was great in the studio. I like to sit out in the room with the musicians, and so I seated about 10 feet away from him, and I was just blown away by, you know, what a great singer he was, and how he really threw himself into the vocals. The vocals you hear on this album are pretty much live vocals.
Can't face living this life alone. I can't bear to think this might be the end.
I listened to this record a lot. To be honest with you, I don't really play the records that I've produced that much for recreation later. You know, that I've been wanting to play this record, and I find some comfort in it. I guess because I feel as long as that music's playing, he's still here.
Another night alone, but I see you in my dreams sometimes. No matter where I go, Lord knows you are always.
That was Don Was, producer on Greg Allman's posthumous record, Southern Blood. With me now to talk about the album and Greg Allman's legacy as one of his closest lifetime friends, he joins me in GPB's Macon studio. Chank Middleton, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing all right. And also with us via Skype is Scott Sherrard, Greg Allman's guitarist and band manager. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Scott, what's up, bro?
Chank.
Gentlemen, before we start talking about the record, I wonder if you couldn't both just tell us briefly about how you came to know Greg Allman. Chank?
I met him in 1969 when they first moved to Macon. I was shining shoes in the barbershop next door to the studio. The studio didn't have air conditioning at that point, and they didn't have a drink machine. But right next door, we had air conditioning and a drink machine. So when they took a break from rehearsing, they would come over to the barbershop to cool off and get something to drink. And they wasn't getting haircuts, so they would all gather around the shoe shine stand with me, and I would shine their shoes, you know.
And how about you, Scott?
Well, I was raised on the music of the Allman Brothers, so I saw my first Allman Brothers concert when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and never looked back. And then I met Greg personally in about 2008 when I auditioned for his band by sitting in with the Allman Brothers.
That's great. Let's talk about the new record, Southern Blood, and let's listen to another clip before we do that. This is from a song called Once I Was.
Sometimes I wonder just for a while, do you ever remember?
There's just so many songs on this record, guys, that seem either directly or obliquely to be about the coming of death. When Greg Allman's death was announced, it was a shock to a lot of people. You know, people knew that he had been ill for some time, but no one knew that he was seriously ill. Did he know that he was dying as he made this record, Chank?
At this point, he did. I tell everybody, he was the person, I never heard him complain about anything. Oh, for the past 6 years, you know, they got diagnosed like, what, 6.5 years ago with it. And from his first time he was diagnosed, he never did complain. He never did even talk about it. Yeah. So when he recorded the album, to me, it was just like any other album he recorded. You know, the songs were good, everything was good. But after he passed and I heard it, it took on that same meaning to me that everybody else seeing in it now.
Yeah.
You know, he knew it was coming, but he didn't tell us. He didn't share it with us. He just bowed out gracefully. That's what he did.
Scott, when you were making it, did you know that it was either intentionally or maybe just by proximity going to be a goodbye album?
Yeah, I mean, there were only a few of us who knew about his diagnosis, and we all knew that he was kind of beating the clock. I myself was sort of in denial because he had so much power when he would perform, and I watched him suffer so much in the time I worked with him with the different complications from his ailments. And but every time he got on stage, he would transform into a lion.
And,
It was no different in the studio. Plus, he was so happy with our band. And like, you know, we had so many laughs. And I know, I mean, it probably to people who are listening to the record now in light of Greg's passing and everything, I mean, it would seem like we were all being serious. But with music, you know, great music is something that happens on the way to getting your next barbecue meal. It's not something you really think about. You know what I mean? Just yes, have a good time and you hang out and you feel it together. And when a group really gels, that was our ace in the hole. And that was what Greg would tell me all the time. Those aren't my words, you know, in terms of, you know, this was his favorite band. And in terms of our live band.
It was. That we had. God, you were. Whew.
Yeah. So we just had a good time, man. And it's interesting because the record is heavy and intense. But we really had a wonderful time playing music together.
We're talking about Greg Allman's new posthumously released record, Southern Blood, and I'm joined in GPB's Macon studio right now by Chank Middleton, lifelong friend of Greg Allman, and also Scott Sherrard, who was Greg Allman's guitarist and band manager and worked extensively on the album, as you can hear. Let's listen to some more music. This is Black Muddy River.
When I can't hear the song for the singer, I can't tell my pillow from a stone. I will walk along by the black muddy river. Sing me a song.
It strikes me as we listen to this album that his voice does sound physically weary, right? But on the other hand, he sounded like that when he was 20. He's always sounded like an old man.
Always sounded like that. You're right. Yeah.
Where did he get that from? He always sounded like this wizened old fellow.
He just had that power to, when he always said, I put it like this, he had a sciatic. He pulled a sciatic like 8 or 9 years ago.
Huh. So it gave him pain in his leg and his back?
He had real bad pain, but he went out every night and performed. But he would use a walking stick to get to the stage. But he wouldn't walk out on stage with the walking stick. But once he sat out behind that organ, I mean, it was like he was brand new, okay? Hmm.
Scott, did he have physical trouble in the studio on this record?
Not that I noticed. Not anything that I knew about. But again, you know, he would mask it by performing it. You wouldn't know. So it was hard to tell sometimes.
True.
Did he complete the record before his death, or did you guys have more work that you needed to do on it after he passed?
Well, we had a lot of ideas for this record. There were a lot of challenges in just getting to the studio to make this record, various challenges. You know, his health, he really loved to perform live, so we were doing a lot of gigs for somebody who was struggling like he was, and then on top of it all, just keeping the whole operation going and the state of the music business the way it is now, it was very challenging. But I think that we had a lot of plans and a lot of cool ideas for this record. And what ended up happening we ended up making, I think, his goodbye letter to his family, friends, and fans. You know, music's funny like that. You can try to, you know, or any creative art for that matter, you know, you think you could plan it out as a group, but it leads you. You don't lead it in the end, you know?
True. Yeah.
Sure. But was it finished at the time of his death, or was there more, you know, mixing or more tracking that had to be done to it after he died?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was driving at. There were things that we all wanted to do. There were some tracks that actually didn't make the record. There was another song Greg and I wrote that we didn't have time to record. Huh.
Do you think that'll ever see the light of day?
Yeah, it's going to be on my record that's coming out next year as a bonus track. So
that's great.
But you know, basically there were various things that there was a song called Pack It Up that we recorded that Greg never got the chance to put any vocals on. There were some loose ends, but in the end, there are no loose ends. I mean, that's really, you know, I'm not going to ruin it for anybody by telling them how we made the sausage. It tastes delicious. It is what it is. You know, it is what it is, man. It's a beautiful documentation of this man's last lap. And I think it's his best record since Laid Back.
I agree with you, Scott. And we can also really thank Don Walls for bringing it where it is right now, okay?
Absolutely.
Because he did an incredible job on his mixing and stuff. He really did.
Let's listen to another track.
Bob Clear Mountain mixed it. Bob Clear Mountain mixed it as well with Don. Okay. I didn't know that actually, check, until I saw him in L.A. A couple weeks ago when I saw Don. We were just talking about the mixes, and he had told me that Bob had worked with him on it. So, but yeah, Don was the linchpin in it all together in the end. You know, that's what he does.
Let's listen to some more music off of Greg Allman's final record, his posthumously released album, Southern Blood. This is a tune called Blind Bats and Swamp Rats. Blind bats, swamp rats, eating down in Mississippi by. Great stuff. Chank, how did Greg Allman toward the end of his life feel about his early work, his stuff with the Allman Brothers, the stuff for which he will always be most remembered? Was he pleased with that legacy, or did he sort of wish people paid more attention to his late career work?
Well, he was very pleased with the Allman Brothers stuff, but he also, I mean, if you look back at he'd been singing when the Allman Brothers left the road. He always had a solo band. Mm-hmm. Gregory was the type of person that he had to work all the time. He couldn't take a lot of time off from work, and that's the way it was with his. Ever since I've known him, solo band, Allman Brothers. That's why you tell a lot of people that when we entered the Allman Brothers tour, you know, everybody was saying, "Well, we can go chill out," and I would tell them, you know, y'all can go chill out, but I ain't going to chill out because we're going right back on the road with this solo band. So I didn't get a break, you know?
Scott, was that your impression as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Greg lived to perform and be on the road. And, you know, Greg was like a real musician. You know, don't be fooled by any of this rock star stuff that, you know, people sometimes put that on people who play, you know, popular music that they're not, you know, maybe they're not a serious musician or they're, you know, they're into the celebrity. I mean, Greg Allman was like any of the, you know, when I was a young kid, I worked with a lot of really incredible older musicians who played blues and jazz and stuff. And he was like that, you know, it was like hanging out with the real guys. There was a real depth to the experience. And he was a musician. That's why he was on the road all the time. Yeah. He was a real musician.
That's Scott Sherrard, Greg Allman's guitarist and band manager. We've also been talking to Chank Middleton, one of Greg Allman's oldest friends, and we've been talking about his final posthumously released album, Southern Blood. Gentlemen, thank you guys so much for being here.
Yes, no problem. Glad to be
here. Thanks for having us, buddy.
And that's it for our show today, but we always love to hear from you listeners. What are your favorite Greg Allman and Allman Brothers tunes? Do you have a memorable personal experience with Greg Allman in particular? Give us a call at 404-594-57 and leave a message or post on social media. We're on Facebook. We're at OST Talk on Twitter. Let's go out on Greg Allman's Going, Going, Gone. For today, it's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea sitting in for Celeste Headlee. Have a good one. Just reached a place where the willow don't bend.